Welcome to Under Lock and Key, news and commentary about prisons from the Revolutionary Anti-Imperialist League. The U.S. incarcerates a greater percentage of its population than any other country. The rate for imprisonment of blacks is four times that of apartheid South Africa, and the U.S. sends more black men to prison than college. The purpose of this program is to educate about and to inspire activism against the American lockdown. This week's guest is Dan, who spoke on the topic of the death penalty at the rail-organized American Prisons on Trial conference in Amherst, Massachusetts in February. Dan will present his conference talk to you today.
When I started doing this, I was wondering how I was going to speak about this issue because the death penalty is often called an emotional issue. People say, oh, let's kill these people, and other people say, well, we don't have to do that. So I was wondering how I was going to talk about this. I have some views on this. I'll start there. I believe it was Gandhi who once said, an eye for an eye leaves the world blind. Well, that's pretty good. And not only does it address the whole eye for an eye line that death penalty supporters often cite, but it also shows the counterproductiveness of these vindictive policies. I don't know if people really believe the whole eye for an eye thing. If they did, the governments of Cuba and Nicaragua would be well within their rights to set off bombs in Washington, D.C., given some of the things that our government has done to them. And the views things that I started talking about, they could be described as, you know, moral decisions, and that's part of the reason why the death penalty is called an emotional issue. There's certainly no need to execute people. This may sound obvious, but in order to execute someone, you first have to capture and arrest them. We basically have the people that we arrest under our control, so the death penalty becomes not a tool for fighting crime, but more of an issue of personal choice. Or so it would seem. It's certainly not my choice. It's the choice of people in Washington and the State House. The death penalty is issued today that, you know, people still feel they're allowed to have some sort of opinion on. With things like foreign policy, you're just supposed to, you know, accept whatever propaganda the government feeds you. More and more, however, this is becoming the case with domestic issues. For example, after President Clinton signed the welfare bill, one of the news talk shows had on two guests. One was George Stephanopoulos. He said that the bill was the best chance to end welfare as we know it. The other guest was a Republican. He also approved of the bill, but thought that Clinton was a scumbag anyways. And that's the extent to which vibrant democracy is allowed in this society of ours. And likewise, this whole issue of the death penalty is being marginalized as well. A few weeks ago, the Springfield Union ran a front-page article about Governor Sununu's new death penalty campaign. The article was titled, quote, "Families Urge the Death Penalty," unquote. What does that mean? All families? I'm sure we could agree that some families support the death penalty, some oppose it, and most families have varying views among their members. Though it's interesting to see the propaganda at work here. Even more disturbing than the title was the subtitle. It read, "Victims Not Swayed by Stories of Death Row Mistakes." Well, there's several things wrong with that. For one thing, it's not true. Some victims, like the one in the article, support the death penalty, and others don't. Tom Lowellstein is a member of the Murder Victim Families for Reconciliation and Mass Citizens Against the Death Penalty. Tom's father was murdered, yet he remains an outspoken opponent of capital punishment. He spoke out against the death penalty at a rally in Boston a few weeks ago. Unlike the event I mentioned in the Union News, which got little media attention. The Lowellstein event? But even beyond that, it's scary to think that people don't care whether or not innocent people are killed by their government. Somehow the executions are more important. The Union News article featured a really tragic story about a child who was killed by his father. The child's now dead, and the mother is trying to get the father executed. This is a pretty standard tactic with our leaders. I remember that last year the governor was exploiting some tragic murder in order to try and get legislators to vote pro-death penalty. I made up a word for this type of behavior. I call it knee-jerk conservatism. I'll explain it to you. Like most people, I get upset when I hear about hideous, brutal crimes. Conservatives, however, look forward to them. It gives them a chance to promote these vindictive, tough-on-crime policies. Normally, your good judgment would tell you these policies are wrong. But our leaders hope that the incident and their constant yelling will promote some sort of knee-jerk reaction like Nancy Flavin's sudden support of the death penalty. And this dependence on hideous crimes will only produce policies lead to more hideous crimes. Our leaders don't really seem to care whether or not these vindictive policies produce more or less crime. I have an article here from a magazine called Extra. It's a publication produced by FAIR. The article is more about youth crime, but it still seems to demonstrate my point about crime policies that don't prevent crime. The article is called Super Scapegoating, Teen Super Predators, Hype Sets Stage for Draconian Legislation. I'm just going to read a few short sections. It says, criminalization of youth of color by the media is not a new problem, but lurid press reports of teen super predators have recently spawned federal legislation that may soon extinguish the rehabilitative intent of the juvenile justice system. Proposed laws have passed in the House and are now pending in the Senate that would try 13 and 14-year-olds as adult and root people as young as 13 into adult prisons. Princeton professor John Diallo invented the myth of the juvenile super predator in the early 1990s, forecasting that 270,000 of these menaces to society will soon be out in the streets, not yet, but soon, by the year 2010. The super predator myth is derived from age-based explanations of crime by Dilotto in league with other academics, including Northeastern University's James Fox and UCLA's James Wilson. Much of their work is the functional equivalent of racist speculation about criminality popularized by eugenicists a century ago. Continuing. Rallied by the media, legislators have sounded the alarm that we must prepare ourselves for the attack of the super predator. In May, a bill originally titled Violent Youth Predator Act passed the U.S. House of Representatives. It allows 14-year-olds to be tried as adults and offers $1.5 billion in law enforcement block grants to states that toughen their laws in compliance with federal standards. The Senate version would weaken the national protection against jailing juveniles with adults. It would require states to try juveniles as adults in order to be eligible for federal funds. Well, so much for the whole decentralization thing that our leaders often speak of. You know, it's fine when you want to rip welfare recipients off their benefits and have states race to the bottom as they, try to compete with each other, but when you want to pass these draconian crime legislations, then you need strong federal support. The law would also allow the federal government to execute people as young as 16. Seldom mentioned in the press are the legislative's dangerous implications. According to the D.C.-based Justice Policy Institute, youth incarcerated with adults are more likely to commit crimes again, 5 times more likely to be sexually assaulted, twice as likely to be beaten by prison staff, and 50 times more likely to be attacked with a weapon than youths held in the juvenile facilities. There's a quote in this article, originally appeared in Time magazine, under the title, Now for the Bad News, a Teenage Time Bomb. The article that followed in Time magazine began, they're just 4, 5, and 6 years old now, but already they are making criminologists nervous. So basically, they've already written these children off, and they haven't even done anything yet. One wonders why our leaders continue implementing these failed vindictive policies. One also wonders why, if the death penalty is just an emotional issue, as some would say, then why is the government and the media so desperately trying to manipulate us into supporting it like they did in this Springfield Union article, and like the way they do pretty much in every other newspaper in the country? Well, the reason for this is that the death penalty is not just an emotional issue, as some would say. It's part of a larger policy of control and exploitation, mostly directed at minority communities. I'll read some relevant stats on this. Only 1 out of 100 convicted murders is sentenced to death. Half of all death sentences are overturned on appeal. Approximately 20,000 persons commit murder in the USA each year. The 200 or so who are sentenced to death are not necessarily those whose crimes were the most atrocious. Instead, they tend to be those who are poor, those who are people of color, and those whose victims are white. Most of those on death row could not afford to hire a lawyer. According to the Washington-based Death Penalty Information Center, more than 90% of those on death row were financially unable to hire an attorney to represent them. I have some other stats that are more related to Philadelphia, but they're kind of relevant here, too. For Philadelphia, over 55% of Pennsylvania's death row inmates are from Philadelphia, which holds just 15% of the population. There are 115 people from Philadelphia on death row. And also, over 90% of Philadelphia's death row inmates are African American, 82%, or Latino, 8%. Death sentences are racist. And I have with me a map that first appeared in the New York Times. So we're moving on to New York. It's a map of the black neighborhoods in New York. And the map first appeared in December 23rd, 1997 issue of the Times. The map is titled The Criminal Communities. The Times considers the black neighborhoods to be criminal communities. And underneath it, it says, 3 out of 4 New York State prisoners come from, prey upon, and return to 7 neighborhoods in the New York City. Some advocates are urging new programs to tightly relate those areas within the 62 state prison. I'm sure you can see the moral concern here, the moral shortcoming of this policy. I have a quote from Malcolm X that might further explain it. This was made in February 1965. It says, so they use the press to create images. At the local level, they'll create an image by feeding statistics to the press, through the press, showing the high crime rate in the Negro community. As soon as this high crime rate is emphasized through the press, then people begin to look upon the Negro community as a community of criminals. And then any Negro in the community can be stopped in the street. Put your hands up! And they pat you down. You might be a doctor, a lawyer, a preacher, but despite your professional standing, you'll find that you're the same victim as the man who's in the alley. Just because you're black and you live in a black community, which has been projected as a community of criminals, this is done. And once the public accepts this image also, it paves the way for police state-type activity in the Negro community. Shortly after after making that speech, Malcolm X was killed. The process still continues today, as evident by the New York Times map of the criminal communities. This is the equivalent of using the flagrantly white supremacist bell curve data as a framework for discussing racial equality. Will the innocent be swept away with the guilty? I certainly don't see the logic in giving this racist government the power to execute people. But this goes beyond the question of the death penalty. It calls into question the entire nature of the criminal injustice system. I would urge you to use your talents to fight against this injustice.
Thank you, Dan. This has been Under Lock and Key, a weekly revolutionary anti-imperialist league program about prisons. For more information, contact RAIL, P.O. Box 712, Amherst, Massachusetts, zip code 01004, or you can email RAIL Radio at mim.org.